Hi, everybody. Today is April 4th, 2024. It's 404 day, but this is the page you seek. It's Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's neuroscience research podcast. Today, our guest is Karen Marshall, who is assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience at Baylor College of Medicine and Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Karen's lab studies mechanoreceptors, cells that detect changes in pressure or mechanical stresses on their membrane. They form the basis for many of our sensory modalities, our sense of touch and vibration and muscle tension, body position, hearing, movement of our bodies, and some I have probably forgotten. But Kara is especially interested in another set of mechanoreceptors, the ones that are our internal senses. We're aware of some of them, like pressure in our bladders or the movement of our intestines, but some of them we're not aware of at all, or at least not usually, like blood pressure. So I'm leaving a lot out of this list, and Kara maybe will fill it in for us before the hour is over. Hi, Kara, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Lindsay McPherson, longtime friend of the podcast.
Hi, Charlie.
Studier of some sensory, other related sensory neurons. And me, I'm Charlie Wilson. Kara, I think that maybe at one time, a long time ago, I would have expected there would be one or maybe a few membrane molecules that would be responsible for all mechanosensation, and that the differences between sensory modalities would just be the cell on which that molecule resided and the forces that are applied to that cell. But now I find myself surprised to find out it's true, because all such hopes of generality have mostly been dashed by experimental fact.
Right.
So tell us about this wonderful molecule, piezo, two molecules, piezo, I guess, and just give us some background on them and how they work and where we could find them.
Sure. Piezo ion channels are these really amazing proteins. There's two of them, as you mentioned, in mammals. They are exquisite force sensors. So they sit in the plasma membrane, and with any changes in sort of stretch in the membrane, it'll open the ion conduction pore. And if it's an interneuron, that'll lead to, you know, changes and maybe initiation of an action potential, for instance. But these are found in a bunch of different cell types where opening this ion channel can lead to electrical changes in the cell, maybe influx of calcium or sodium. So what's cool about them is that they're expressed all over the body, and they are, as you kind of alluded to, important for so many different mechanical senses. We don't think about the mechanical senses a lot. I think we think about senses generally. We think about external senses and how we sense maybe odorants or, you know, tastants or photons or something. But mechanical force is intrinsic to everything in our body. And it turns out that these piezo ion channels are really critical for that particular mechanical sense in a lot of different places. And so when they were discovered in 2010 by Erdem Patapudian's lab, which we share as a mentor, it was really exciting because people had been looking for this mechanosensor for decades. People started looking for a mechanosensitive ion channel in the hair cells of the inner ear, in the cochlea, which we know that's a mechanical sensing sensory cell, right? So that, you know, that field goes way back. And when piezos were discovered, turns out they're not really, you know, apparently that critical for hearing, but they're important for all of these other mechanical senses. So it's kind of funny because the way people originally searched for these ion channels is they looked in lower organisms, flies and worms, and tried to find mechanosensory proteins. And they'd always look up into mammals and it just never quite translated. So when these were discovered in 2010, it was very exciting because they were all over sensory neurons, and sensory neurons are important for things like touch and knowing where your limbs are in space, the sense of proprioception, thanks to muscle stretch. And it turns out piezo 2, which is all over sensory neurons, is responsible almost entirely for these senses. As we alluded to, it does a lot of different things. And so in some ways it was really lucky that, you know, the discovery of these sensors just broke open the field of mechanosensation, because now we know they're in all of these places where they function really specifically to sense mechanical cues. And so that can lead us into new avenues to understand physiology, right? Because then by using the molecules and understanding where what cells are contributing, then we can actually start to parse how mechanical forces are driving different physiological processes, if that makes sense.
So So are they not found on flies and worms and things?
So they do, yeah.
They just weren't discovered.
Yeah, they weren't discovered that way, but flies have a piezo, worms have a piezo. There aren't two of them. There's usually one, I think, in a lot of these organisms. I think even slime mold has piezo. So it's very well conserved, but it was not discovered in sort of the classic way that people discover these things, where they kind of hunt it down in sort of simpler systems and work their way up. It was sort of discovered, I think, from a very clever approach, which, you know, people have been hunting for it for years, and Ardem's lab and Bertrand Coste actually decided to take an approach where they just screened cell lines that were mechanically sensitive. They're like, let's just poke a bunch of different cell lines, see which ones have poke-induced responses, and then do, you know, comparative genetics on those and see what genes are differentially expressed. And then Bertrand went one by one and knocked down all those differentially expressed genes until he got to FAM38B or A, which, you know, we now named piezo. So piezo 1 and 2.
So it's a huge, magnificent-looking thing for a molecule. I guess it needs to be big like that so that, because it depends on leverage, actual mechanical leverage to be sensitive, so that small movement of the membrane would make a big movement in the pore.
Yeah, I think that's probably one thing that contributes to it being very good at mechanosensing. But there are smaller mechanosensors, too.
So maybe the size isn't...
Yeah, but I have wondered, you know, how much that contributes. It's certainly the shape of it contributes to its function in a really beautiful way.
And so all these differences between forms of touch are really just boiled down to where the cells are that... Mm-hmm. that contain this and what neurons connect to them.
Yeah, in the skin you have so many beautiful neurons that detect different kinds of touch. Like, we think of touch as one thing, but of course you can tell the difference between, say, the stroke of a feather and like the touch of a finger and a pinprick, right? These are all very different sensations. And it really is because you have this beautiful complement of mechanosensors. Some of them wrap around hairs to detect hair movement. Some sit at the surface of the skin to detect indentation. That's sort of the combination of all of these inputs that formulate the sensation of like a different touch or a breeze or an insect crawling, right?
So what they all have in common is that some cell, some neuron, gets its membrane
deformed. Yeah, that's right.
Somehow. Yeah. So there are senses that are not, there are somatosensory receptors that do not rely on this, like temperature, I guess.
That's right.
And those are distinctly different, functionally different. You can tell them apart because they're something other than just deformation in the membrane.
That's right.
And then there are all of these receptors inside that most of us don't walk around with a list. Well, we probably don't walk around with a list of our somatosensory modalities either, but I can't even begin to form a list of all the interoception. The ones I mentioned are ones I heard you say at some point today.
And
it's true that you can really tell when your intestines are moving around or when your bladder is full. But there are a bunch of other things, too, that we detect, internal things that we need to be able to detect. How many of them are there? What are some of them?
Yeah, I don't have a number for you.
I know Lindsay knows about some of them, but they are chemical ones.
Yeah, chemical ones. Yeah, there's a ton of different chemical senses in all of these different organs, too. I mean, it depends on the organ. I mean, I think I mentioned today that the gastrointestinal tract is really complex as a mechanical organ, right? And you have, you know, everything from peristalsis in the esophagus down to stretching of the stomach, contraction during digestion. Even the mucosa seems to be mechanosensitive. These all probably have distinct functions in the gut. Even the enteric nervous system might be a little bit mechanosensitive. And so I couldn't begin to, you know, say a number of different interoceptive senses, but certainly different organs have different complements of mechanosensors based on the function.
It seems like making a list is now possible. Whereas before, you'd have to, for example, if you wanted to know how many different mechanoreceptors are there in the digestive system. You could imagine some physiologist sitting down, manipulating cells at different places in the digestive system, and then trying to figure out the function that each one is. But that hasn't mostly been done, has it?
Not really, because it's, you know, we're just at the level of figuring out what is the transduction molecule, right? Which I'm assuming is mostly piezo two, but you know, it could be piezo one, piezo two. There aren't a lot of other candidates, honestly, out there right now.
So it seems like an opportunity.
It's an odd, huge
just look
opportunity.
And find all the piezo two.
Well, doing that functionally, I think, would be really powerful. Which is one place my lab definitely wants to go. Which is physically looking at the sensory neurons as you stimulate the GI tract is something that is really a priority in my lab because of this exact reason, mapping, like who's responding to what? I mean, that's kind of a basic question and it's crazy. We still don't really have the full answer. People have done this like kind of with, you know, older school techniques where you maybe do electrode recordings, like, you know, drape a nerve over some electrodes and do different kinds of stimuli, but you can't see different cell types, right? You can't see the cell bodies and how they're responding. So I think there's a lot to be learned from just mapping that out, like you say.
And it's extra tricky because like the DRGs, right? They're separate DRGs at every level of the spinal cord. And then within the DRG, it's all a mishmash of sensory neurons. Yeah. And similarly, the nodose ganglion jugular complex is a whole mishmash of these same cells.
Yep.
And
Yeah,
there's no real head or tail to their organization in the ganglia, which is a good and bad thing,
right? Yeah, it makes it hard.
It makes it a little tricky, and then figuring out, because their peripheral axons are so long, and then their central axons are also pretty long, especially for those ganglia, right, that terminate all the way into the brainstem, right?
Yeah.
I have a similar challenge in that way of looking at these cells and where they're receiving information and where they're sending their information.
And I will say there's some beautiful work, I mean, thanks to, you know, people like Steve Lieberlis, who's done beautiful vagal imaging, and like that's come a long way. His lab has done beautiful work in that field, and other labs too. I don't want to forget anyone, but the DRGs are still really hard because they're encased in the vertebra, and so people are starting to do this, but doing it at these thoracic levels in the mid back is they're very tiny and there's a lot of movement, so it's tough.
So I should probably say that's where the cell bodies are.
That's right. Yeah,
they give rise to these processes that go everywhere. So processes that are giving sensation to the finger and to the toe, they look a long way away from each other, but things all get kind of collected where the cell bodies are, and the cell bodies don't have any markers on them. They don't have any letters on them telling you which one goes
where.
Where
it goes, yeah.
So in the interoception, one of the things that lowers our knowledge is that we don't have any we don't really have introspection to tell us very much. So every single thing that has to be controlled by feedback, so every kind of autonomic thing that needs a sensory side to the circuit, all of that stuff is operated through these mechanoreceptors. They are the sensory side, and some of them we know about, but probably most of them we don't. And maybe blood pressure is a great example of the kind that we think is super important, but that we don't feel it. We normally don't feel our blood pressure. And there must be many other things like that, like decision about when to empty the stomach into the small intestine, and decisions about the secretion of things that have to be secreted at particular points in digestion. And all of those are controlled, they're under, most of those are under some kind of sensory control. So those sensory neurons are not common knowledge to us.
Well, I mean, it is true that a lot of those processes are thought to be mediated by vagal sensory neurons and just sort of the autonomic nervous system more classically. But I think more and more we're realizing that the sort of classical divisions whereby, you know, our conscious senses like touch and proprioception that are coming through the spinal route, through the DRGs, and that these sort of unconscious or automatic or autonomic systems are kind of coming through like vagal loops. I feel like that's getting smeared a little bit, that the definitions aren't so clear and that there probably are things, say, sensed by DRGs that we may or may not be aware of. And so I think, again, we're still kind of figuring out the cell types that are doing all of these things. And I think that there's a lot of room for exploration and discovery in figuring out, you know, how DRGs are integrating these cues in sort of automatic reflex loops that we don't control and in sort of conscious sensory perception. And it might not be so clearly divided as I think the assumption has been for years. I don't know if you would agree with that.
But I agree. And I think, you know, your kind of tool development method with your FM143 dyes could actually, you know, kind of lead to some answers along the way.
Yeah.
Is there a way to do your, so you've been able to show that FM143, if you add it peripherally, and then if those neurons are activated, FM143 goes through piezo channels that are open, yeah, or potentially, yeah, like, at least, yeah, looks like that way, right? Yeah. And so if you can do this labeling in kind of like a, you know, naturalistic scenario, you have the mouse walk around, or you have the mouse, you know, have a full bladder or something, and then go look in those ganglion neurons, you can probably find their cell bodies really nicely. Could you then even do imaging on top of that some way, yeah, or is it not compatible with doing calcium imaging if you label them?
I think that's really interesting, and I've thought about combining the two. I mean, one of the problems, FM is an amazing tool. The hard thing is that so many processes rely on piezo-2 that it ends up just labeling so many cells, so that your background is actually, it's not background, but real labeling is just very high to start with. But I have thought about using FM-043 as sort of a, at least it would label the subset of what we think are active piezo-2 active neurons, right? So it would help kind of target maybe where you image or something like that. But, you know, it's going to get all the touch neurons, it's going to get proprioceptor neurons, and so if we're looking at these internal cues, maybe in the thoracic ganglia, it'll be a little easier just because we have fewer touch neurons there, and although there's still plenty. But yeah, that's the hard part. But I think it's a really good idea. And like, we can pile them on top of each other to get a little bit of an idea in vivo of where the mechanosensors are when we're in the ganglia, like looking there. I wish there were a better way to kind of restrict FM locally. Right now, we just let it circulate all over so it gets all of the mechanoreceptors.
Oh,
and I haven't tried local, because that would be nice, right? If we could just get, say, like, stomach neurons, and I haven't tried anything to do that yet. It would be great if we got that to work. That would be really cool.
So the piezo-2 is on the cell bodies as well as everywhere else on the cell. Is that true?
Well, I would say we don't know for sure where it inserts in the membrane, but I would guess that it's probably not in vivo. Probably not in the membrane in DRGs. Uh-huh. And then instead it gets trafficked out to the endings. Where,
so when you see it in a DRG, that means it entered in some faraway place and somehow made it all the way to the cell.
In reference to the dye, that's exactly what we think happens. The dye is, if it's true, which we haven't proven it, but we have a lot of data suggesting that it goes through the open ion channel. That's happening at the sensory ending. And then that dye gets trafficked back to the cell bodies. And we know that because we don't really see labeling in the cell bodies until at least like maybe 12 hours after injection. But if we look at cell bodies that are a lot closer to the endings, like in the nodos, we see labeling earlier.
I see.
And so even like in the endings themselves, I had this idea that if it's really activity dependent, endings that are activated a lot will label faster. And so that actually does happen. Like the aorta endings label in 90 minutes. You see beautiful labeling. And those should be active in a mouse many, many times per second, hundreds of times. In the skin, however, that labeling takes a lot longer to accumulate. So I do think it's related to kind of how active the ending.
So you could inject it into a target region.
Yeah, and maybe it would stick around, you know, to like
the
only
hard part
like
is
those.
Keep it there
that would
long
be
enough.
Cool. Yeah, it's possible. Should try it.
A little FM-143 pump.
Yeah, local infusion.
Localized.
That would be nice, actually. I mean, once it gets into the bloodstream, I assume it kind of like goes everywhere.
Sure, yeah. Maybe you could keep it like, but if you had it like in the bladder, like inside the bladder even, and just like a slow drip in the bladder.
Yeah, I thought about trying that, but I never got around to it. I wonder if it would permeate. I don't know. You know, the bladder is very good at keeping things out, actually.
Yeah.
It's doesn't want urine to leak in. But yeah, I don't know. That would be good. It's lipophilic. It could happen. So,
in your experiments, you control bladder pressures. In your little diagram, it looks like you've penetrated the bladder.
That's
somehow.
Right. Yes,
is that what
we
you do.
Yep.
You actually
we open it up and put a catheter in so that we can control the filling rate.
So that hole doesn't leak. How do you keep that hole from leaking?
You have to like flange out the line so that it's like, you know, a wedge, and then you tie it really tight. That's it. But the mouse bladders are very tiny. It's a lot easier, actually, in, say, a human. You can catheterize through the urethral opening.
Yeah.
Mice are just so small that we haven't really done it that way.
But. Well, then, of course, your experiment requires that the bladder be able to empty, too, right?
So, mm-hmm.
I mean, you have the advantage of
that's true.
Clamping
we can pull pressure. It in and then, and then let
so
it go.
So that sort of brings us to the experiments about the bladder. So the bladder is heavily innervated.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly so, but maybe thinking about it, it makes sense that you would need to have exquisite knowledge about how much, what the pressure in your bladder is. And then all of that is controlled. And it's true that we're aware of pressure in our bladder, but we're not really aware of all of these feedback controls that are actually governing our behavior and our interpretation. So the bladder is expanding in order to not have a big increase in pressure as it fills up. And so having pressure sensors in the wall should be decreased by to the extent that that happens. And then only when the bladder contracts is there like a big peak of
pressure. And what I was showing in the talk today, remember, is a pressure trace from the bladder where the peaks indicate that the bladder is contracting back onto those saline lines, right, that I'm using to read out pressure. But it's interesting to think about what is the stimulus for us feeling a full bladder. Because you're right, the bladder accommodates to take in incoming urine, and then when it reaches this threshold, initiates this contraction of anamictrition. And
the threshold presumably is a, is that a sensory threshold, or is, do you think that's a threshold in the spinal cord somewhere?
I think it's a sensory threshold. I think the sensory neurons are probably activated to some degree that then kicks off these other reflexes. That's my guess. And people debate whether it's really stretch or pressure. I think that there's a lot of evidence saying it's really the stretch is the stimulus. But of course, pressure causes stretch on membranes. And that's definitely true in the urothelium and stuff too.
I see. So just having it
actually expand itself,
is
right?
Stretch
and it's
almost.
And I always present it really simply, but it's a little more complicated, as you know, in biology it always is. But your bladder, it doesn't just passively expand. It's actually the fuller it gets, and this is Martin Nelson's work. The fuller it gets, the more you have these like micro contractions of the bladder. It's almost like the bladder is feeling its own fullness a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's thought that sort of the hyperactivity of this muscle is tied to your sensation of urgency. And so the fuller it gets, the more you have these micro contractions until it reaches a threshold and then it all goes together. But the way the muscle fibers are, you just have like, you can see these like almost like little calcium sparks and sort of subsets of the muscle as it sort of have these little micro contractions. So it's not as perfect as it relaxes and then it contracts. It's sort of a dynamic feedback system.
Very elaborate.
Yeah.
Elaborate.
And it's all, you know, again, we take it for granted, but if you don't urinate, you die. So, you know, of course, we've developed all these elaborate ways to control when and where we urinate, because also if there's a predator around, you're in danger, or it's, you know, now we're highly evolved males, so we think about appropriateness, and there's all these ways that we need to control this to not do it in an inappropriate time or place. And so, of course, there's a lot of top-down control from your brain. And when I give a talk, I always talk about, like, the local reflex arcs. But I sort of ignore the brain part. But of course, the brain is actually really key for us going to the bathroom. And that's what is able to like integrate all of these external cues to say, am I in a safe, appropriate environment for this? So the brain actually initiates these cues in a normal functioning adult.
So some of the other things that are controlled like that. I mean, we've talked about blood pressure, but we haven't said much about blood pressure.
Yeah.
So blood pressure is sensed by cells with PSO2 in the vasculature.
Right. And they're neurons. I'll point out, I'm talking specifically about the neuronal baroreflex, or the neuronal reflex that senses blood pressure. There's a lot, your body also has a lot of different ways to control blood pressure. This is, again, tightly regulated. But one of those ways, one of the fastest ways is through stretch-sensitive neurons. Some of them sit in the wall of the aorta, and some sit at this particularly stretchy part of your carotid. So when you feel your pulse, the reason you can feel that is, you know, kind of where it forks. It's very stretchy, and there are baroreceptors there too, which is also why if you press someone's neck, they can faint. Because what that does is it says, oh, pressure is really high when you stretch these. And your body has these feedback mechanisms to modulate, to keep your arterial pressure the same, right? So if you squeeze your neck really hard and fast, your body's gonna be like, whoa, blood pressure's so high, let me just stop your heart real quick and expand all your vasculature to compensate, and then you faint, right? And
so you're actually studying the Vulcan like drop frequency. Like, what is that called? In the,
I know exactly what you're talking about, I don't know what it's called.
But, yeah. Spock would go like this, and then it's pounded out. Yeah. Right.
And so that is mediated, that neuronal bear reflex. We didn't study it in that way, but it seems that the neuronal baroreflex is mediated by both piezo 1 and 2, actually. And it's kind of interesting because it was one of the first things we found that really requires both ion channels. And I kind of mentioned this in the talk, but in the autonomic nervous system, in the nodose ganglion, you have both piezo 1 and piezo 2. And there's also, you know, other sensory neurons that take in this information from the carotid. And so it seems that both sensors work together and that they compensate for each other. So if you knock out only or take out only piezo 1 or take out only piezo 2, the baroreflex is intact. But when you take both of them out, that reflex is abolished. And so that's really exciting because, you know, you've also alluded to the fact that these reflexes and some of these processes have been studied for hundreds of years. Like, we've known about the baroreflex a very long time, but it was very exciting to find, you know, the sensor responsible. And this is thanks to the work of Weizheng Zhang, who's a lab member in the Patapoudian lab. And so it was cool to actually find the molecular basis for this reflex that, like, every med student learns about, you know.
And there are people who have a deficit of PSO2, mm-hmm. and they are alive. Yeah. So that means their blood pressure is regulated at least well enough.
Yeah, they have piezo-1 also. And so we even found, even in mice, we found that piezo-1 is enough for that reflex.
But for those people, there are all sorts of other rough patches in their life. Like, they close their eyes, they can't tell the position of their limbs.
That's right.
And you can imagine what that's like trying to walk. Mm-hmm. And they... And they don't have any sense of touch. They still can feel pain, but not light touch, which sounds terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only thing I've ever felt is pain. What a sad thing to say.
There's a couple other things preserved, right? So deep pressure, they can sense. Uh-huh. And there's, like, very specific forms of touch, like gentle stroking on the hairy skin. You know, they can sense certain modalities. But for the most part, they're, like, profoundly touch insensitive. Can't sense vibration. And like you said, they can't estimate where their, you know, limbs are in space. And this is the work of Alex Chesler and Karsten Bonneman, wonderful collaborators at NIH. And, you know, in collaboration with these individuals that don't have piezo-2, who, again, were really generous with their time to fly to the NIH and, you know, undergo a lot of testing to help us figure out what piezo-2 is doing in the body. So it's pretty amazing. They never knew they were missing touch, right? Because they'd never felt touch before.
And if I grip something, I can tell how hard it's gripping because I'm detecting my muscle contraction. Yep. And that's also...
That feedback. Right? Yeah, the haptic feedback is super important and very touch dependent.
So very hard to, like, pick up a fragile container and not either break it or let it go.
Yeah.
And I wonder, there are lots of these theories about movement, about how we make a movement, like forward and inverse learning or... models for movement that really rely on us making a model of what our proprioceptive feedback is going to be like.
Right.
And if we've never had any proprioceptive feedback, the entire learning of movement must be disrupted, and alternative strategies must have been found, or else these people could not move.
That's exactly right, yeah. And so one test that they've done, and again, this was work from my colleagues, Doctors Bonneman and Chesler, is they will have someone maybe, like, put a target there, and they have to kind of touch from their nose to the target. And it's this ballistic motion of, you just kind of get me to the target. That's intact and kind of fine. It's these kind of fine movements, right, that rely on this feedback, like you mentioned, that are really difficult. Because you can sort of move your muscles in broad strokes, but all of the refined movements we do rely very much on proprioceptive feedback for smooth motion. We tend to take that for granted, right?
So do you do get to talk to some of these patients?
I have not actually yet, but Alex and Karsten and Dima Saad, who worked with me on this paper, and many others at the NIH have all had extensive conversations. And they, again, these individuals have been so generous with their time, because this is, you know, the urination paper, I think, was a great start to something beautiful where we come together and use information from human individuals and their lived experience and combine it with mechanistic work in animal models. And I think that gives us a much richer view of how piezo 2 is involved in whatever we're studying. And now, you know, my wonderful colleague Rocio Cervantes has done this with the GI tract to understand how, you know, GI motility might be affected in these individuals. And there's so much to figure out there. And so, we're really grateful because these individuals have been so patient to come in and answer a bunch of questionnaires and undergo testing. It's really valuable.
It's the ultimate behavior genetics experiment. Yeah. You have the person right there.
That's right. And I mean, like you said, it's just being able to talk to them and ask them questions has been so revealing because we can't do that for mice, you know? Mm. So to say, what do you feel or what do you not feel has been really, really important.
What's next for mechanoreception? What's the strategy? What are you planning to do? Are you going to stretch out and look at all the different kinds of interoception?
I like the idea of stretching out. It's so appropriate for this. Yeah, I'm trying, you know, with a new lab, there's so many directions you can take. The possibilities are very exciting. But the reality is, of course, we have to try to focus on a couple things that we can get done. And trying to think about what are the big questions that we are particularly well poised to answer. I think there's still really important ones in the bladder. There's remaining mechanosensation in the bladder, even in piezo 2 knockout animals. And so we have some ideas of other sensors that might contribute. And then I really want to understand internal pain. So when we think of all of these internal organs moving, again, we typically don't feel them, right? But if someone has inflammation, they become very acutely aware of their internal organs. And so how this switch happens from sort of mechanically silent to mechanical nociceptors firing or mechanical pain neurons firing is really interesting to me because it's thought that maybe these sensors are sitting there not firing and then something about inflammation turns them on and they become unsilenced. And so it'd be really important to figure out why that happens. And then, as I mentioned, the gastrointestinal tract is this huge project where we have so much to figure out with regard to the basics of who is sensing what in the GI tract and how that might contribute to feeding behaviors, right? You eat a full meal that stops you from eating more. How is that sense of stretch maybe integrated into known feeding circuits? And as a neuroscientist, I'm really excited about this because there is this really rich history of feeding in neuroscience. They know kind of a lot about the different circuits that contribute in the brain. And they know a lot about different circulating hormones and how that affects feeding, but we're sort of missing the mechanical side of this regulation. So I feel like there's a great opportunity there to sort of plug in, you know, what are the mechanical inputs to this system? And then like my fun farther afield stuff is really thinking about how internal cues shape things like anxiety. And this is, you know, a lot of the, you might hear woo science about, brain-body connection. There's real tractable ways we can start to understand how senses from different organs might drive fear, anxiety responses in an animal. And so we, again, have molecular tools to start parsing if any of these mechanical senses might contribute to some of that. So that's a little bit farther away, but a fun, exciting area to think about.
Well, that sounds great.
We'll see what we actually do.
Thank you very much for joining us, Kara.
Thanks for having me.
And Lindsay.
Thank you.
Awesome.
And this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.